giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. I'm Ben, and I'm here today with my buddy Derek. Hey, Derek.
Hello.
How has your week been?
My week's been a little short. I'm taking a little bit of time off, heading over to the West Coast. So I'm currently sitting in an Airbnb in Portland right now. Yeah.
What are you there for?
Just to hang out. Wanted to take a little vacation here just to recharge a bit. And there's a number of folks out here in Portland, actually from kind of the bootstrapper community, MicroConf attendees kind of clustered here in Portland. So just got a chance to spend some time with them and hang out and check out the city. And it's pretty cool.
Nice. I've been to Portland a little while ago. It was a good time.
Yeah.
It felt like Cambridge, but a little rainier to me.
Yeah, it has been raining the whole time we're here, which is not bad. I feel like I've been to Portland twice. This is my second time. The first time I was here, it didn't rain at all. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably not the true Portland experience. So
yeah, exactly.
Getting the full effect now.
Cool. So you're on the move.
Yeah.
So you're meeting up with local bootstrapper folks a bit as you're there?
Yeah. I reached out to Ruben Gomez from BidSketch, lives out here, and one other guy who I know from MicroConf that I knew have lived here. So I reached out to those folks, and they do a little meetup once a month. And so connected up with them, and I just all of a sudden started seeing more faces that I didn't even realize lived here, which was pretty awesome. I'm like, hey, that guy, I know your name.
Nice.
So, yeah. And then a lot of the folks who live here have just moved here in the last few years. So I guess it really is true what they say, like everybody is moving to Portland.
Is that a thing people say?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing definitely the locals feel. Like,
you
never want to say you're from California if you're in Oregon, because they really don't like Californians.
I heard this interesting thing from a guy who I think is like an urban planner. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that the model back in the 60s and 70s, if you were a city and wanted to grow, was you would try to become really attractive to businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So you would build big roads and lots of parking lots and lots of commercial zoning and highways and things like that. And you would try to lure businesses there because then the businesses would bring people.
Right.
And Portland went the opposite route. And Portland built for people and a couple other cities. And what happened as tech kind of happened and just the world changed. And now companies go where people are.
Yeah.
And people are in Portland.
Yeah, I can totally see, like, it's a different experience when you're hanging out in downtown Portland. They call the open vistas concept or something like that, where it's like streets have to be a certain width and buildings can only be so tall. The idea is you're able to see like three or four blocks in every direction, standing on any street corner.
That's cool.
And I did like a tour of Portland the first time I was out here doing kind of the touristy things. And that was pointed out to me by a tour guide. It's like, yeah, that really does. Now that you pointed that out, it totally makes sense. I can see it.
Yep.
And I think that's been in progress since, I don't know, 50s or 60s. So there's been a lot of planning going on for many years.
Totally. Portland is very serious about like mixed use infrastructure. So it's like if you're going to build a road, you build a road and then space for a trolley car and a bike lane and a sidewalk.
Right.
I love it. I think they're one of the, there's like two or three like cities like have like a gold ranking for bike infrastructure in the country. And I think it's Boulder and Portland are the two that are up there.
Yeah, and Minneapolis is pretty strong too on its bikeability.
That's awesome.
I've heard that there's more paved bike trails in the Twin Cities than there is in Portland. But that might just be because of the, you know, sheer size of the geography. But
That's awesome. I love a city with good bike infrastructure. It makes it feel so much better to me. Cool. So I just got back from a conference. Went to Big Snow Tiny Conf. I think I mentioned that last week.
Oh yeah. Yeah, how was that?
It was great. This is my second year. I went last year out in Colorado, and this year was up in Vermont. And so it's a 12-person conference. Retreat is maybe a better word for it.
Yeah.
But so we spent 3 nights there, two of the days went skiing together, and then do like talks and mastermind-style sessions late into the night each night. And of course, like on the lift, like everyone's basically talking business all the time.
Sure.
And it was great. It's like people that are doing kind of similar things to I'm doing, some with more experience, some with less, some in different. One of the attendees like runs a whole bunch of cell phone stores. So like physical retail locations.
Yeah.
And some of them were e-commerce, like selling wheels and tires, things like that. So it's a really interesting mix of people that are all running businesses, but like different types. And it was great to get ideas and get inspired and help offer advice to other people. It was, I really enjoyed it last year and I enjoyed it quite a bit again.
Do you feel like you're able to learn things from, like, talking to a dude who runs a brick and mortar store? Like, is there crossover?
I wouldn't say there's so much direct crossover, but it's interesting where, like, so he has a ton of sales experience because his business is basically all in-person sales. And so he's hired hundreds of salespeople. And so one of the things that we're considering is hiring sales folks ourselves. And so I was, like, running that idea by him and getting some input and some ideas, like, where do we find these people, and just kind of riffing on that. And, like, sales is a general enough concept that he could definitely offer some advice.
Cool. And for a conference like that, is there designated speakers per se, or is it just kind of like high caliber of attendees talking to each other?
It's more the latter, but everyone gets a time, a specific slot. So it's like we all got at least like half an hour to 45 minutes to do kind of whatever you want.
Got it.
So some people, actually none of them I would classify quite as talks. Mm-hmm. So often people were sharing like, here's what we're working on. Here's what's worked well for us. Mm-hmm. And almost always there would be some sort of back and forth. People like would say, well, what do you think of this? And have you thought of this? Have you tried this? So it was like very collaborative and less like of a lecture style talk. Mm-hmm. But we all, you know, went, we all got a turn. So it was cool.
Yeah, nice.
It was interesting too. There was, I think it was just one person there who was still working a normal full-time job and not running a business, but had like a sort of an idea. And he sort of pitched us on his business plan, which we sort of unanimously agreed was like way too ambitious for like a first try kind of thing.
Yep.
It was like, I'm thinking of getting into hiking, so I'm going to hike the Appalachian Trail. And we're like, maybe start with something a little more feasible. But it was just, it's good for me, I think, to go and see people more experienced and less experienced, because you get different things from each person. Mm-hmm. And not to say that like the less experienced person was, it's just, I have learned a lot of things along the way. And when you see someone who's like a little bit behind you, you can say, oh yeah, that's right. Like I take for granted some of these things that I've got now in my tool belt and some of this knowledge I have. And it's kind of nice to have that pointed out.
Yeah, I feel like it's a good reminder of like the fundamentals that you already know. Like we're always taking in so much information all the time, and sometimes it's conflicting advice. So I feel like learning by teaching like kind of solidifies where you stand on certain things. So if, you know, someone's pitching you on a business idea and you're like critiquing it for them or helping them evaluate whether it sounds viable or not, you're kind of like pulling out of your toolbox and forming advice and ideas. And I've found that it has often helped me to recall something that maybe hasn't been in the forefront of my mind and, you know, could actually be helpful in whatever I'm working on in my business.
Totally. So, yeah.
Kind of learning by teaching, you know?
Yep. There's a saying in med school, which is watch one, do one, teach one.
Yeah.
So when you're learning like a new procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's that last phase where like it really kind of gets locked in.
Yeah.
So it was a good opportunity for that.
Yeah. I found that a lot too, like in school doing tutoring, like even if it's the same subject matter that I just learned last week, if I tutor somebody on it, then it's all the more solid in my brain and gain a deeper level of understanding. So.
For sure. That's cool. And as you'd imagine, there are like a lot of strong opinions too. It's a little bit of a free-for-all kind of, where it's like you have no context, or like it's hard to get much context in like a short time. And so everyone's kind of throwing out these ideas and like, you should do this, you should think about that, have you thought about this? And it's like, some of this is maybe good advice, some of it's maybe not. It's kind of hard to tell, but there's an idea flow coming at you, which is good. Yeah, so I took down some notes and got some inspiration, and I have some things I'm excited to try out.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Do you feel like a conference like this becomes an echo chamber?
Because
I recently read a blog post. Josh Pigford from Barometrics wrote a blog post. I thought it was pretty interesting. He titled it something like the startup industry is an echo chamber and is making you deaf or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind it is that we often will just kind of listen to other people within our same community who are reflecting back the same ideas back and forth amongst us all. And if you're not bringing in information from outside sources or just people completely outside of the tech industry, you can end up kind of just in an echo chamber, essentially.
So I think that's definitely a possibility. One thing I tried to do specifically at this conference was not offer advice that I had heard, but offer advice only when I had like a personal experience around it.
Yeah.
I think that like, if you can just like, oh, I know the prevailing wisdom on this thing, let me repeat it to you. That definitely can create that situation.
Yep.
And I don't know to what degree that was happening from other people, but I try to avoid that explicitly, where it's like, I don't know much about this thing, so I'm not going to say anything, even though, you know, I read a blog post one time, or I read a blog title one time that suggested something else.
Yep.
So I think that's definitely a concern.
Yeah. I like that approach, though, because I feel like we can all end up with so much hearsay.
Yeah, exactly. And who knows? I feel like situations are so can be so unique too. So it's like, yeah, mm-hmm. you know, the prevailing wisdom on X is that you should do Y, but like, who's to say that really applies in this situation? Like, yeah. how much advice is there that applies to everything always? Like, basically none, right? So we got to be. I try to not repeat that too much.
Yeah, the more I learn, the more my answer is it depends. You know, mm-hmm. like I feel like when you're learning. Like the early fundamentals, everything in your mind is absolutes and you're like, no, you should never have a free plan and you should never raise VC. But now it's right. like, well, now I'm starting to see the gray, you know?
Totally.
So,
yeah, I think that's happened to me in every field that I've mm-hmm. gotten or every field I've gotten more experienced in is you see the gray. And yep. I will say that when you are a beginner, I think it's valuable to have those black and whites actually.
Yeah.
Like black and whites will be close enough for you as a beginner often.
Yeah.
When someone's brand new, I often will eliminate some of that nuance
yep.
and say, like, just don't ever do this for now. And right. then, like, we'll know, like, when you know enough that you start to question that, you'll yeah. be able to sort of decide for yourself if it's time to ignore that rule.
It's like starting in beginner mode, and then, like, once you've learned enough, you can go, like, full manual transmission. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Start, like, yeah.
Or it's like if you're, like, you're learning to cook, like, just follow the recipe. Don't improvise. Yep. Like, measure yep. the salt, measure the pepper, like, do all that stuff. Like, don't, no flexibility at first.
Yeah. No, I think that's sound advice.
Yeah. So just like what happened last year, like I really like this conference because I find it inspiring. Like there's people to look up to and like good mm-hmm. ideas come out of it. And it's like I was jotting down a lot of notes, particularly mm-hmm. around marketing automation. Brian Castle or Cassell. I don't even know how to say his name. I've known him for a couple
it's
years.
Castle.
It's Castle. Great.
Yeah.
Brian Castle is mm-hmm. there. And he is leveraging Drip quite a bit in his like marketing mm-hmm. funnel for audience ops in an intelligent way. And in a pretty, it made me realize how little we're doing. Like we're getting, I'm getting emails. We have emails showing up in Upcase like pretty regularly. And we are totally underutilizing the fact that like we now have people's emails and can market to them.
Right. Yeah.
So there's a lot. I'm realizing how much work I have to do, but I think it's going to be very useful. Make money work. So
yeah,
it's cool.
Worthwhile.
Yeah. So I have a question for you.
All right.
Which is there a noticeable person or position that you hired in the history of Drip that had a really strong impact?
I think probably the most pivotal hire we made was when we brought on Anna. So before hiring Anna, it was Rob was heading up kind of just the marketing side of things. I was heading up the development side. We had a few junior devs on the team mm-hmm. at the time.
Like contractors?
Actually, they were local and they were their actual employees, not contractors, okay. full time that we had... sponsored a Rails class essentially at the little startup building going on in Fresno. Uh-huh. And so I taught the class for 6 weeks and then we hired two junior devs out of that class.
Huh,
so really brand new to Rails, but we couldn't find any Ruby developers really. There were like, there's a handful and they were all employed. So mm-hmm. once we kind of made it through that batch of folks, you know, we had no other options, but we wanted to experiment with the local approach and working out of the same office at least part of the time. So, mm-hmm. and we were budget constrained, so we couldn't necessarily, you know, hire a bunch of senior devs right away.
Right.
So that was definitely instrumental getting more developer help.
Yeah. I'm curious, not to divert too much, but I'm curious how well that worked.
Yeah. It worked pretty well. I mean, there were definitely challenges, you know, training junior developers while actually trying to pick up the pace essentially of the features we're building. So I would say it was rewarding because, we've gotten to see these folks, you know, learn more about and become level up their experience. And so that's been rewarding and just mentoring and all that. But, it was challenging to not let that slow us down as well.
Yeah. That would be my concern, but you felt that like sort of net it sped you up.
Yeah, I think so. And we deliberately picked people who, you know, maybe they didn't have a whole lot of programming experience, but it was clear that they had a knack for kind of the fundamentals behind programming. And so like we spotted the opportunity there. One was who's still with us, was a philosophy professor who was looking to do a career change. And so he has like really solid understanding of logic and how to reason about programming problems, even though he wasn't really a programmer before this.
Yep.
And then the other junior dev that we hired had been like hacking projects together. He was a brewmaster for a brewery and he had been hacking together like Excel macros and things and basically doing ad hoc programming here and there to make his job easier. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he started getting into the craft of programming, he was all about like doing things the Ruby way and learning the best practices. And, you know, he was just really on top of that stuff. So we kind of recognized the potential in these folks and kind of leveraged that as we mentored them.
Okay. So you have a team of three developers?
Team of three developers and just Rob by himself kind of doing marketing. And I think I've talked about this before in past episodes, but we were starting to get more and more people who wanted to see demos of the product. They wanted more hand-holding, kind of like sales, essentially, but inbound requests for it. We were never planning to go out and solicit sales in that in the early days. But
did you have a request, like a request a demo button?
We eventually did.
Uh-huh.
But prior to that, people were just emailing in to support saying, like, can you demo the product for me?
Huh. I've never gotten that email for any of our products.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's probably because, once we started reaching past the innovators and the tinkerers, you know, we were reaching, you know, people inside of companies who were making buying decisions were starting to, you know, hear about Drip. And I think those types of buyers really wanted to get the full high touch experience, I guess.
Okay.
So it didn't happen right away, but it just was something that was gradually starting to happen more and more. So our first response to that was to record demo videos and just send those, email them, those to people. Then Rob would occasionally like cater them custom to the person's use case. So they would describe what they're doing and he would, I'm not sure if he would reuse parts of the same video and just like record a new intro or if he would do a full custom one. Mm-hmm. It's probably kind of on a case by case basis. But that really wasn't scalable and, you know, he's only one person. So around the time we brought on Anna, things were starting to really click in. We found like we were finding our market. We achieved product market fit and bringing Anna on just, really allowed us to scale that side of things.
Mm-hmm. So what was she spending most of her time doing?
It was crafting our demo funnel. So started out just doing like anytime someone would request a demo, she would send them a Calendly link and, you know, hop on a call with them and do the demo. And I'm trying to think there actually might be a public talk. She gave a talk at MicroConf.
Right.
And she kind of talks about architecting the demo pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be the best way to get like the full details. But there were basically four phases that I think. And the first one was just sending out the videos and then progressively the demo funnel improved over time. I don't have those phases in my head right now.
But yeah.
It was like a year process to basically hone in on the optimal demo pipeline.
Huh. So interesting. And so that had sort of like the bit to you, that was the most noticeable impact.
I think so. Yeah. That correlated with increase in trials, increase in revenue. Converting trials. I mean, we were bleeding out a lot of trials because people were not getting the high touch experience. They wanted more education. They wanted us to sell them on why Drip was better than the alternatives.
Yep.
And having a person dedicated to that helped.
Was she mostly working with people that had requested a demo explicitly, or was she doing any like rescue missions where it's like, we have these trials that are clearly not activated. They need help. Go help them.
Yeah. I think there was some of that. I think a portion of what she was doing early on was, I think we call them like account strategy calls, where it's like a, you know, someone's already in and they need help setting up their account.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure actually the mechanism that she found, like who needed help. I know we've gotten more advanced over time on trying to figure out who might need help, like asking, what's your current subscriber count when you sign up for a Drip account? And if we know then if that person hasn't uploaded their list yet, they probably need help moving their account over or architecting it. So,
I like that. I was talking to one of the conference attendees this week, and he was saying that he was having a lot of people sign up for trials and then not be successful. And basically, so he never activate. He had like this step that was like, if you don't do this, clearly you're never going to get value from the product. And so like anyone that's not over that line is in trouble.
Yeah.
And he said, I was like basically desperate. He's like, it was a desperation move. Like I needed to rescue more of these trials because otherwise we weren't going to grow. And so I just started doing this thing where like if a couple days in they hadn't reached that point, we would use Intercom to do like a full page overlay of like, hey, we don't offer this to everyone, but I'd like to give you a strategy account, like this, the thing, I forget what the words were for it. It had a good name for it. It was something like consultation. It sounded like a consultation, more or less. And we often will charge $200 for this, but we're gonna give it to you for free. Click here to schedule with me. And like he would offer that and then offer it again if they didn't respond, and then email them if they didn't respond, and like just kind of like get kind of aggressive about trying to get somebody on a call to talk to them and help them out. And he said that, so he's only been doing it for a couple months now, but he says that so far, the churn rate of people that do the call versus not is a third.
Mm.
And it's like, that's huge.
Yeah.
And that's, at least for his business, I imagine for many, like, that's got to be a good ROI for you.
Yep.
It's kind of a simple thing, but like, we're not doing that very well on right now. Like, we have, like, FormKeep has a trial and we're converting something like the mid 60s of the mm-hmm. percent of those people. And so mm-hmm. it's like, you get a lot of people that signed up and gave you a credit card and like expressed interest and then just it didn't work out for some reason. But I'm sure we could capture some percentage of those people back if we helped them. And we send them some automated messages like, hey, like, you haven't done this. Do you want to do it? And like, you haven't done this. Do you want to do it? And then it's kind of like, never. All right, we give up. Just fine.
Yeah. Do they normally just kind of go silent, like no response to any of your attempts to?
Yeah, they don't answer those. We get almost no people answering the message.
Yeah,
but I think it's less like, hey, can I help you, and more like, you haven't done the thing yet, like, you should do the thing. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tough. I mean, it's hard to get information from people who are either voluntarily churning or just involuntarily churning out. You mm-hmm. know, does someone have to explicitly cancel? Because you're collecting credit cards. So yes. Is it like, if they don't hit a cancel button and go through the flow, then they will get charged? So
yes.
They have to do that step?
Yep.
What kind of post cancellation follow up do you guys have? Is it
just an it's basically email? One email, which is what's really short. It's like, hey, is there anything we could have done to save your business?
Yeah.
And that's it.
What's your response rate look like on that? Is it?
I haven't looked at it in a while. We do get responses from it. A few roll in a couple every week, and that feedback hasn't been super useful. Actually, I would say it's mostly kind of like, oh, like, I was using it on a client project and we stopped.
Yeah.
Or like, I just wanted to check it out and I kind of poked around and now I'm done. Which tells me that there's probably other cancellation reasons that I'm not hearing about that would be more useful that we could like follow up on better.
Yeah. One of the things we added, I think this was from the get go when we allowed self-cancellation in Drip, which I'll mention it, but I don't have metrics on how helpful it's been. But we have, like, when you click cancel, we bring up a modal and it's like, are you sure you want to cancel? And we'd like tell them, like, you have this many subscribers in your account, and if they have a conversion goal created and they've received conversions, we're like, we've already made you this much money. And then at the bottom it's like, yes, I'm really sure I want to cancel my account, or click here and support will reach out and assist you with whatever you need help with. Like, if you need help, we're here for you. And a handful of people on a regular basis do click that button, but I don't know how effective that's been on actually saving their accounts. But a lot of times I recall like, sometimes people just have like a trivial thing like, oh, I couldn't figure out how to send a campaign, so I'm canceling. And it's like, oh, well, we can definitely tell you how to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
that's an interesting thing. Yeah. We just let them cancel. But yeah. Doing that sort of like last second rescue thing, I bet would save something.
Yeah.
But to me, like, once they're like ready there and clicking the cancel button, you're probably, that's such a last ditch thing. But like, I can predict when that's going to happen. Like, if you sign up for FormKeep and you never send us any data, you're going to cancel. Like, I don't need to like guess that's going to happen. And so if it's been a day or two, like, our successful people send us stuff almost right away. Like, they make a form, they send data, and like, they're integrated on their site within like an hour. And so if it's been a couple of days, you're probably in danger, and we gotta reach out to you.
Yeah. And I guess that's where like the trial onboarding funnels become so important.
Yeah.
Like, we have every other day, there's an email nudging you to, and we're tracking in Drip, like, whether someone has accomplished certain steps, like activating a campaign, uploading their subscribers, activating a workflow, whatever. And we're like, hey, you haven't done this yet.
Totally. Yeah. And so we have like a couple of those emails, but we're not great about it. And also, it's kind of like, if you do the bare minimum, we stop emailing you, as opposed to saying, oh, hey, now that you've done that stuff, that's great. By the way, there are a couple of these other great things you might want to know about.
Right.
Like the Zapier integration, for example, is really useful, and some people just don't know about it and they don't do it. So there's like things we could be telling people that would help them have more success.
Right.
So I think that's a really fertile part of the funnel right now that I'm going to go spend some time on and see what I can achieve there.
Yeah. It's just all incremental gains from that stuff, you know, like, probably nothing's going to be like a giant bump, but all added up, you know, it accumulates.
Totally. Yep. That's the beauty.
Yeah.
If you get a 10% lift in like any phase of the funnel, that's like, that goes to the bottom line, right? It flows all the way down. So,
yeah.
Cool. Yeah. All right. I guess it's going to be a slower week for both of us, but we can wrap up right there.
Sounds good. Today's show was edited and produced by Tomato Obarski.
If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/228. Thanks for listening.
We'll be right back.